Welcome to Mastering Sustainability. I'm Madeline Armstrong, Sustainable Partnerships Manager at Okeanos. I have a master's degree in sustainable business, but as the industry evolves, I'm realizing there's just so much I have to master. Each episode, I'll be joined by Ray Laughlin, our Degradation Innovation Director, who brings years of experience in the science of sustainability. However, despite his extensive knowledge, he still feels like there's so much he has to master in the ever-evolving language of ESG. From carbon reporting to understanding the alphabet soup of the acronyms at the UN, there's so much to learn. If you have concepts you've still yet to master, stick around and we're going to tackle them together with the help of industry experts, academics, and friends alike.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Mastering Sustainability. I am, of course, your co-host, Ray Laughlin. And alongside me, as always, our main host, Maddie Armstrong. Hey, Maddie, how are you doing today?
Ray, I think we need to stop advertising you as our co-host. We're equal co-hosts.
In gender equality,
we are equal co-hosts.
Listen, I'm all about being woke and ready to use all the right terms with people. We all know I'm the co-host here. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about that. I'm not going to dispute it. And I don't think you should either. You are absolutely
the main host. You're going to dispute yourself when we listen to this one back.
No.
You did a great job. This is a great episode. Listeners, I think we're really excited to dive into what happened in COP27, what we're looking towards in COP28, carbon offsets, and where we're going from here.
Mike was an absolute pleasure to have on. I see why you and producer Nikki have an infatuation with the guy, because now I've grown that as well. It was really good to have this conversation with them. I think we're trying to hit our stride here. Sometimes I feel like our first half blends in with our second half. This was perfect. This was, if you're tuning in for a nice overview about ASBN, COP and potentially carbon offsets, you've tuned into the right one for the first half. And then if you want that in-depth deep dive about what to expect at this coming COP28, and then a really deep dive into carbon offsets and how they work, you tuned into the right episode.
Yeah, Mike and ASBN has been an incredible resource for us. And me and Nikki do very much enjoy working with ASBN and in the leadership groups with Mike.
In summary, for the first half, you're going to learn about ASBN and the 250,000 businesses they work with on sustainability, how challenging the role of ASBN is, and the critical involvement they conduct at conferences like COP28, which is upcoming, and can the private sector be the bridge to make the change from oil to more sustainable climate action? Take a listen.
Today, we're hosting Michael Green on the podcast. Mike joined the Native team as an expert on carbon market policy with a background in project development. Over the past 10 years, Mike has dedicated his work to advancing ambitious climate policies at the local, federal, and international levels. As the Climate and Energy Director for the American Sustainable Business Network, Mike works closely with the leading boards to support winning advocacy campaigns. Previously, Mike served as the Executive Director of Climate Exchange, a Boston-based organization focused on providing research and technical support for the development of carbon pricing policies. Mike, welcome to the podcast. It's great to have you here today.
Hey, thanks, Maddie and Ray. Thanks so much for having me.
Off the bat, Mike, what's your role? What do you do?
Yeah, so I am the Director of Carbon Markets for a firm called Native, based out of Burlington. But today, I think one of the things we're going to get to talk quite a bit about is my role with American Sustainable Business Council, where I lead their Climate and Energy Working Group. In the past, ASBN has been really focused on the role of U.S. businesses in international climate negotiations, and we're headed right into the next upcoming COP. So I'm excited to share some insights and some of the things that your audience can be on the lookout for as we get ready for that, you know, usually quite fever pitch news cycle that surrounds the COP.
I can't wait to dive into this topic with you today, Mike. But before we do get into the meat of the episode, can you give us a little background of how you got into your role, maybe what education path you took, and maybe any other little jobs that led up to where you're at today?
So I say that I started with climate change, the issue, and really grew with climate change, the industry. When I was going into college in the early 2000s, there wasn't a career professional or path to deal on the climate crisis. That wasn't a thing. You know, it was still very much a issue that people sent nice sentiments about and cared about, but there wasn't all of the amazing tech and policy and innovative solutions and ideas out there that we have now. So I really think of my career path kind of mirroring and maturing as the industry itself has. You know, as you hinted to education and how my education might have played a role in it, I went to Northeastern University, go Huskies, up in Boston. And, you know, Northeastern has a great program called the Co-op. And the Co-op allows you to spend 6 months deep into the career field that you're pursuing, actually in a professional capacity, and then you return back to the university. Although unlike many students, I went on my first co-op and then I dropped out of school. I didn't go back for about 2.5 years. And during that 2.5 years, I worked the job that would eventually help me pay to go to college. I worked the job that, you know, would basically put money in my pocket to survive and be able to be a young 20-something living in Boston. And then I picked up every single unpaid climate-related organizing and activist internship that you possibly could. Almost every single one of the major climate-focused nonprofits in Boston, I had some stint volunteering or working and being involved with them. But it actually was a chance that I got to be in Geneva with the IPCC that really helped me break through and be more into this space. So I took a lot of risks. I took a lot of chances along the way in my career journey to get where I am now. But it's really exciting because I'm one of the lucky few who gets to really use that environmental science and international affairs degree to good use.
All right. You mentioned a couple of different organizations, and let's define them. IPCC was one of them.
Yeah, the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. So the IPCC is the scientific body to the UNFCCC. So UNEP, the United Nations Environmental Program, within their climate change kind of area of focus, they have the scientific body and then the policy body. And the two are supposed to work and inform each other. So the IPCC comes out with these grand reports, sometimes focused on climate solutions at almost a global and monumental level. And then sometimes they focus in on very specific questions or areas of focus. But the way their studies work is to bring global governments together to create consensus around climate science to then inform the policy over at the UNFCCC.
Wow. And then now ASBN, which I think we're going to touch on more in this conversation with you. You're leading the Climate and Energy Global Group?
Working group, yep. So ASBN is about 250,000 businesses spread out across the United States. They represent all sorts of industries, business types, ways of doing business even. But the thing that really brings them together is this shared value. And I should say that Okeanos is a member of ASBN. We're really excited to have you guys as a member. But the goal of the working group specifically is to bring some of those businesses and brands together to support meaningful climate and energy policy. And we've got a lot over the last few years to hang our hat on, some very major wins, looking at the bipartisan infrastructure bill, as well as the Inflation Reduction Act, the IRA, where ASBN had hundreds and thousands even of businesses send in letters, making phone calls to their congressional aides, and even several trips down to DC, where we sat down with political leadership to represent the business narrative in those policy conversations. I think that the business narrative is really important to have representation in DC because so often climate ambition is hindered by economic concern. And so when you have small businesses able to sit at the table and say, actually, we want to see even more ambitious action taken, and we're not worried about the opportunity of regulatory oversight or what it might mean to our business because they see the long-term sustainable goal as the real objective.
Yeah, I don't think we can say enough kind words about our membership with ASBN over the past 2 years. But producer Nikki and I sit on the Circular Economy Group, but we have sat on quite a few of the climate working groups as well that Mike leads. And it's just always such a pleasure to sit in those and listen to other businesses around the United States.
Well, I'm going to assume there's going to be a bit of a biased answer, which I don't blame you on. But with 250,000 businesses situated in an organization that is working towards sustainability goals, What type of role does ASBN play in these global conferences with so many businesses participating, giving viewpoints? I have to assume you play a significant role in some of these climate conferences.
Yeah. So the COP process is especially an interesting body where you have nonprofit and advocate or environmental organizations there, of course. You have all of the global governments there in attendance. The challenge, though, that we've seen most recently is this real pushback on the role of business within those negotiations. And I think ASBN's involvement is a great way to show how the private sector is not necessarily an obstructionist, but can be really supportive of the things happening. So a funny example would be, you know, when I first started working with ASBN and started working supporting private sector businesses and their sustainability goals, a lot of people, you know, I worked for Greenpeace and Rainforest Action Network and, you know, some of the hardest hitting corporate focused organizations in the space. And there was a lot of questions and concerns about like, well, what do you mean you're going to go work with the private sector? And to be honest, a lot of the times in my training, or if you will, within these organizations, they were vilified. They were the bad guy, the target. But the reality of it is that so many businesses shared the same values as that activist organizer community that I was coming out to. They just have a completely different point of leverage. As a community leader, as a business owner, you play a different role within the fabric of your community. You have more trust with your staff, with your clientele, with the people who do business with you. And it's really important to use that leverage to activate people and get them involved, get them interested in climate policy and what's happening within these international arenas. So I think we play a critical role in representing what it means to be proactive businesses within the conversation. And I'd say in the previous administration, when Trump was president at the COP, it was even more important for us to be there, to be a contrarian voice, as much as it's helpful to be supportive. So we can hold our government's feet to the fire a little bit and make sure that they hold up to the level of ambition that we want to see, but also to be there to provide political coverage when they are going to go out there, you know, maybe risk being questioned in their ambition on what it will mean for the U.S. economy or put U.S. at a disadvantage maybe to other global governments that we're trading with. It's really important for us to push back and say, actually, here's where we're going, and the U.S. business can play a constructive voice within those conversations.
For a brief period, I was one of these that was probably, oh, business is bad. You can't involve them in the environmental sector. And then I got into a sustainable business, and I realized how important that private sector voice is on what is actually going to be said in the room that can have direct consequences to economies, to jobs, to all sorts of different facets of life. Where do you draw the line? Where do you draw the line with the public guidance versus the public sector's advice that both need to be used in sustainability?
You know, I often find organizations like ASBN and some of our partner organizations and our brands a really important bridge there, right? A great example is on the most recent clean power plant replacement rules coming out of the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency here in the US. A lot of groups who have dirty fossil fuel infrastructure in the backyards of their communities were there saying, we need to see further regulation, we need to see further guidance, and we need healthy, safe communities. It's really important to hear that from the general public. But that was a great kind of false narrative where we saw that, and then businesses saying, well, wait a second, how are we going to conform to these regulations? This is going to cost people money, and kind of bringing up all the same red flags questions that they normally would. Our businesses were able to be that bridge and say, actually, here are businesses that are already looking at investing in renewable energy or ways that they can source clean energy for their production or for their manufacturing or for their business in general. And so I think that the business voice is not a blip from the public voice, but it's actually, it can be, when constructed well, it can be two sides of the same coin. That can really help make the argument that climate action is good for businesses, good for public health, good for economic health, good for the future of our planet and for future generations, and also good for innovation and business growth.
So Okeanos is part of a business coalition for global plastic treaty alongside WWF and EMF. So following the INC3, what type of conclusions can we expect out of COP28 to help further this global plastic treaty?
That's a good question. You know, the COP coming up is, first, let's start off where we're being hosted in the UAE, United Arab Emirates. First time they've gotten to host the COP. It's very important that and it fits into this question that petro state is hosting the COP this year, and they have tons of interest in continuing the use of fossil fuels. Yet one of the big pushbacks and one of the big challenges that we're going to see this year is that there's going to be, for the fourth year, a call for a hard phase out date from the global use of fossil fuels. I think that really supports and would be able to move the conversation quite far in other negotiations and conversations as it relates to plastic and other petrochemical usage. I think that's one outcome that we should all be keeping an eye out for. Much like loss and damage before it and other topics, you've really seen things swirl for a few years before they actually land somewhere in any kind of negotiating and documenting text. So maybe this is the year for that. Now we're going into a little bit of a challenge. It's maybe an understatement, but you can't ignore the global geopolitics happening around this COP. Right? We have multiple wars that are happening, from the continued fighting in Ukraine, which maybe we can touch on and how that's having a very different impact, to actually just global security, and specifically security in the Middle East, as all of these global leaders, about 40,000 people from around the world, show up in UAE in a little bit over a week's time. So we're going to see how these geopolitics get in the way or dominate the conversation. And then how does that take away from things that are some of the more ambitious bits, like putting a global phase out to fossil fuels that is going to be a continued push at this upcoming COP?
From my line of work, I mean, I'm on the sales side of the business. So I do a lot of sales presentations. I talk to people all over the world about our products throughout the Middle East. It doesn't matter whether I'm talking Saudi Arabia, UAE, Qatar. You know, we're trying to grow our business in multiple areas. But when I present to them a technology like ours at Okeanos, where we're trying to substitute out as much petroleum oil as possible, I get the under the table answer a lot of times of, ooh, that's not our state's stated goal. Essentially, we're stated to continue using it. So I try to phrase it usually like sustainability should be something that we're all striving towards, even if it is in smaller steps. And in reality, sometimes sustainability can help a petroleum company, because essentially you're making the necessary steps. You can show that you're genuine in your goals, and yet you're still able to continue selling your materials. However, you just stated it. The UAE is the central figure of this because they're hosting the entire thing. This COP's president was CEO as Abu Dhabi's national oil company. How likely do we actually think that getting petroleum companies to take a step back is? In my mind, I think so many times these types of conferences are ways to slowly try to tighten screws. And it sounded there in your answer just now, there's a little bit of hope that we actually might be able to get concessions. Is this pie in the sky stuff, or is this actually where you think we're going to be able to get something this time?
So this upcoming COP is a global stock-taking COP, right? So it's the very first time where every country is going to be reporting on their progress to their national determined commitment to the Paris Agreement. So we signed the Paris Agreement in 2015, and they've been coming up with their own national determined contribution. NDC is the acronym we use. And their NDC kind of all gets stacked up in a line. And we see when we put them all next to each other, if we're actually on the right trajectory to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees centigrade. And right now, the science tells us that we're vastly off.
Okay.
But one of the things, though, to answer your question on like the optimism is, in order for something in my mind to make its way into a text within the COP process, it has to have made its way into several leading countries' NDCs who have then somewhat normalized the idea, or at least socialized the idea in the practice. And to be frank, there's a few countries where they just will never put anything in language that goes above and beyond, like the United States for that matter, what that country is willing to commit to because of sovereignty risk and this consensus model that COP has been built around that is very much bottom up. So now to answer the question, if we zoom out a little bit, are we seeing a phase out or a call for phase out of fossil fuel usage by global governments? And the answer is yes. We're seeing this in the transportation sector. We're seeing this in the energy sector. We're seeing this as blanket moving away from fossil fuel statements from countries as a whole. So it's already making those early steps that I think are really crucial for an idea to actually catch fire and happen. It's when we come out with this big, ambitious goal that hasn't been tried or introduced at any government's level, that it then people are left feeling like they fell flat on their face when it doesn't happen. But from the more practical standpoint is it's bottom up in consensus models for everything that they decide upon. So, of course, they're going to need to see this tried out and see some leaders in order to bring everyone along. Now, how much pressure does the government face, or how much pressure do they feel to even have this COP be a success, I think is really going to be a fascinating process. Now, one bit that is starting to become even more clear, and I hinted at this earlier in the show that we would talk about how the war in Ukraine is helping to shape these negotiations in a very real way. So the COP meeting moves locations every year, right? In each location, it's decided upon by all of the governments, and it rotates geographically around the globe. Next year, we're up for, I believe, for Eastern Europe or for the European bloc. Russia has announced that they're going to veto any country that is supporting Ukraine or supporting NATO in their endeavor from hosting the COP. So that actually leaves you Belarus, Azerbaijan, and a few others, like very, very small states that have shown no interest to throw their hat into the ring. So what does this mean? This means that actually UAE could host next year potentially as well. So we could be actually looking for the next two COPs that are chaired and led by a petrochemical state. So how does that change the level of ambition from this COP to the next? If this COP isn't viewed as a success, I think there's going to be a lot of questions around UAE's ability to host the next COP as well. So all of these things are yet to be figured out, but that's certainly going to have a heavy role in the context for how fossil fuel industry plays this out on whether or not they think they're going to have a lenient head of government as far as from a regulatory perspective at this COP. Versus maybe if they were to pick up and go to a much more progressive European country next year that has, you know, ambitious goals around fossil fuel phase out already, there may be a little bit of gaming of the system that the fossil fuel industry has to play around COP presidencies over the next 2 years.
I got to say, I love the inside baseball of this stuff. And the fact that I feel like I'm going on a tour of COP history and the COP politics of everything with you, Mike. I'm enjoying every bit of this stuff.
I love talking about it. I get to nerd out about it. And I'm such a loser well, maybe that's kind of rude to myself and to the students who are still doing this. But I did, you know, Model Arab League and Model United Nations and all that as a student. And that was just totally my own little nerd world. So the fact that I get to do it now in real life is just as much fun.
That's so interesting. I mean, I'm learning a lot. There's so much around COP that I think is so confusing and hard to understand. I know the UAE is one of only 29 countries to submit a revised second NDC ahead of COP. How is the public going to view maybe countries taking a step back and saying, we set this ambitious goal, now we need to revisit and set a more realistic goal? Is that truth and that honesty over the greenwashing of we're going to continue on this path of this ambitious target that we know we're not really going to meet in 2030 or 2050? How does that play with the potential of it coming back in 2024 for COP29?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. And one of the things that's exciting right now in the climate space, you know, going from climate change, the issue, to climate change, the industry, one of the things that has really grown in the industry is our ability to track, verify, and report greenhouse gas emissions across industries, sectors, and governments. A lot of NDCs, what governments are saying is being accomplished and what they hope to accomplish is like quite easily verifiable and measurable at this point in time. And so I find that a lot of governments are looking to increase the ambition of their NDC year over year. We've had some small hiccups. The Bolsonaro administration changed the baseline for Brazil's NDC a few years ago, which threw it wildly behind what they should be moving forward towards. And with the new administration, Lula in Brazil, Brazil's back at the table and is looked at as a leader. Actually, more than any NDC update that we're going to hear going into this COP, one of the pieces of kind of pre-COP announcements that is going to really move the conversation the furthest is the US and China announcement last week to continue working on global cooperation around climate change. That's through setting renewable energy mandates, through looking into their manufacturing and working, and gosh, maybe even the ability to pick up the phone and call and speak with each other and have more frank conversations than speaking through the media or our militaries or whatever else was the previous channel, which is a bit horrifying to think about. But yeah, the agreement of US-China collaboration is really going to, I hope, show a unified front.
I noticed that meeting that happened in California was right before COP. And the announcement about environmental change was one of the big hallmarks of that meeting. Yeah. So I thought that was very interesting leading into COP.
I've seen days in the waning hours of the COP. You know, the COP always runs past when it was supposed to end. Mm-hmm. And it's like the twilight hours of day three overrun into the weekend. And people are hustling between the United States. We'll have a cohort of people around it. And then you'll see China or whoever they're caucusing with will have a huge group, and people are running back and forth and trying to create some kind of semblance of balance in order to get an agreed text done. Getting the agreements to collaborate out of the way in advance really shows, hopefully, that we're not going to have multiple groups trying to war against each other, a little bit more of a constructive conversation going into the COP.
To wrap up the first half of this podcast, I really want to just end with a way for our listeners and consumers in general. You know, how can they get involved with COP28? You know, I am someone who does like to read about these types of things, so I do read the articles that are out there. But outside of that, are there ways to get involved? And you talked a lot about the statistics that these nations are going to be giving out for the first time ever. Call me the nerd or the loser if you want to. I find that fascinating to see who is setting the bar high, low, meeting it, whatever it may be. Where can we find those statistics?
Yeah, the first bit of your question to follow the COP and how you can be following along with the process, I would use IISD, the International Institute for Sustainable Development, does a daily brief.
Oh, you mean the one that's linked in our description? We'll link it here so you can follow along, listener.
Perfect. Yeah. So that's a great way to follow the dailies that's happening. And then there's another group that we'll share called NDC Partnership that breaks down the various NDCs and allows you to understand what the governments are saying in these NDCs, because sometimes it's really tricky because they're all using different baselines. They're using different metrics of success, different timelines, and all of that has real meaningful ramifications. So maybe you see 40% reduction of emissions by 2030, and that sounds great, but they're calling for it in only the energy sector, and maybe their energy sector is already mostly decarbonized. So there's all these little contextual pieces that I think NDC Partnership will do a good job of breaking down and helping you understand really how ambitious are these countries.
And there's the midway bell. Maddie, this was billed as a bit of a COP28 lead up podcast. And I think that's what we're delivering so far. I have talked to you guys a lot, and maybe this says more about you and producer Nikki on trying to explain COP28 to me. I'm learning a lot from Mike in just a half an hour of him talking about this stuff.
Mike is so well spoken on these issues, and he is the perfect person to have in this discussion. I mean, the development we've seen from COP27 and the lead up into COP28, I think all of these discussions around carbon offsets and the lead up to these conferences are really important to have.
With what he's told us so far, I'm finding his optimism about this type of event infectious. And that's something big for me, because I am not that way. I do not get hyped about these things. I don't think world-changing ideas come from these events a lot of the time. But if Mike's the one kind of leading the charge here, I might be able to get on board with it.
I definitely know your stance on the red tape and how those types of projects go. So I agree with you.
And now, listeners, we get to talk a little bit about our parent company, Okeanos. Okeanos is the creator of Made From Stone, source reduction technology that enables brands and manufacturers to reduce the plastic and CO2 emissions of their products by substituting renewable calcium carbonate. If you want to learn more about Okeanos and what our technology can do, please visit our website at madefromstone.com or engage with us on Instagram at @wearemadefromstone. Producer Nikki, cue that music.
In the second half of this episode, we're going to talk about the role of COP and its development of carbon markets, unique development of those carbon offsets, and do offsets actually work? Producer Nikki, hit the music. Welcome back to the second half of the podcast, listeners. Oh, God, that was such a long break. I'm really glad that we got out and I went for a 5-mile hike in between. Yeah, it was good to stretch your legs. Anyway, jumping back into it, I think we're going to dive a little bit deeper into COP overall, what we're expecting, what we'd like to see, and the inside baseball that Mike's already provided us so much of. Starting off, offsets seem to be a big deal this year. And according to Maddie, this is a close to your heart subject, Mike. Can you first explain to us what exactly is an offset and how is the system being set up to work for everybody?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And jump right to the punchline is that it's not, right? It's not being set up to work for everybody, but that doesn't mean that we should stop trying making it work for everybody and making it work in a way that is progressive, inclusive, and quantifiable and transparent and all the things, the buzzwords that I'll try and steer clear of that the industry uses. But this upcoming COP is a little bit of an interesting time for carbon offsets or the carbon market as a whole. And we can get into explaining some of the elements of it as well, if that's helpful. But maybe I'll start with saying the carbon market was actually something that was in the precursor to the Paris Agreement. There was a thing called the Kyoto Protocol. And this was what allowed essentially global governments to trade emission reductions between predominantly the global north and the global south. The Kyoto Protocol broke countries down into what are called Annex 1 and Annex 2. Annex 1 were your developed countries. Annex 2 were your countries that were still at the point in time of the mid-90s moving forward with their development strategy. And so what it dictated was that Annex 2 countries or the global south would be able to sell emission reductions, essentially since they've already have a very low emissions profile to begin with. They could sell any added emission reductions to those global north countries. Now, a few things happened between now and then, between the Paris Agreement that sets up this context. First, you had a whole host of countries that were considered developing in that Annex 2. Now that are looking to buy carbon offsets, not necessarily just generate them. So whether that be China or Brazil or countries really across the global south that are looking at much more inclusive involvement within the upcoming market. Now, in the climate movement as a whole, offsets are still something that is a ton of questions and concerns around. I didn't start out in this space. as somebody who is looking at carbon markets as the silver bullet. But what I have been able to see is that when you're able to create meaningful climate offset projects, you're able to create targeted ways for finance to flow into innovative solutions or into communities that otherwise wouldn't have any other opportunity. It was actually through organizing in Massachusetts and working in Boston around some of the challenges of creating a regulated carbon market in that state that I started to observe this. When the idea of allowing a corporation to pollute and to get away from that pollution by buying a forestry credit from Brazil really made a lot of people have pause. What does this do for the Massachusetts state economy? Mm-hmm. But when we took the revenue from that carbon offset and we invested it back in ideas like public transportation for marginalized communities that didn't have access to public transportation, then all of a sudden it had a lot of support. Mm-hmm. So we know that in the public's point of view, it's not as cut and dry as people might make it sound. I think we understand that in order to transition the global economy away from fossil fuels, it's going to require trillions of dollars almost on a per country. And in order to do that, we have to look at every type of finance mechanism available, especially in ways that we can get capital coming out of the private sector over into some of these solutions and opportunities. So there's a lot of ways now that we can think about, okay, what are things that we can be investing in that reduce our emissions? But unfortunately, the market as it's been set up to date has really been a race to the bottom. Corporates want low prices. Project developers in the carbon space want to maximize their margins and yield the least amount of out-of-pocket costs to a project's actual development. And it's created this downward system. However, there's a lot of groups that are coming in now to create standards, create ratings, and create essentially verification bodies to make sure what you're buying is actually what you put up the money for in the first place. And I think all of that is pointing towards a more mature, better consumer market in the end. So coming into this COP, carbon markets isn't actually a headline issue. So the way that it normally happens is that an issue like I was talking about with a phase out of fossil fuels makes its way into a main text. And then over future versions of that text and of the working groups that get established upon it, they then start to create the bureaucratic structures and the rulemaking that actually moves whatever the pre-signed commitment is forward. So what does that mean for carbon markets? Well, in the Paris Agreement, we decided that we would create a replacement mechanism to that CDM that I was talking about. Mm-hmm. And then we decided, okay, we have these three articles that are really important. Article 6.2, Article 6.4, and to a somewhat of an extent, Article 6.8. And these are all essentially create enabling frameworks for carbon markets to exist within the Paris Agreement. Now, in this upcoming COP, they actually have, well, how's this mechanism going to work? What are the rules for a project? What are the rules for a country trying to make such a trade of emissions? And all of those rules maybe aren't going to grab the headlines because it requires a pretty substantial knowledge of understanding the market forces and how these things impact those market forces. And it's a lot of speculation. But the reality of it is it's great for all of us who maybe are following this space. Because it's for the first time a big green sign, a big green light saying, let's go, let's get these governments involved. Let's really see if we can continue to help scale the carbon market and scale it in a highly credible way.
So longtime listeners, all five of them to this podcast, will know that you said one of my perfect trigger scenario words, silver bullet. I got to tell you, though. After that dissertation on carbon offsets, it feels like there might be some form of that silver bullet here. So kudos to you for changing my mind on that one term as it stands. I do want to ask, though, can you give us a few examples of carbon offsets? You know, I hear the big one of an airline plants more trees. Okay, they offset the carbon over the next 100 years. Are there other versions of it? Like, is that the main one everybody points to is the trees? Or is there some other way that we can look for carbon offsets?
Yeah. So looking for carbon offsets is actually my job. So you certainly asked the right person. And Native is actually a project developer. As the director of carbon markets at Native, we go out and develop these carbon projects, and we do this really unique business model called Help Build, where we work with our brands who come in at the very beginning of a project, provide catalytic finance to get that project off the ground. And then they have a agreement for what percentage of the carbon claim from the project for a set period of time their initial investment essentially is worth. And it allows them to move away from buying from a retail market where maybe they have a hard time validating or understanding a project and you're just getting a carbon offset without much context around it. In many situations, our brands even go out to the projects themselves and they're there from the very beginning of the project's life. Now, of course, the brands that we work with have needs and commitments that go above and beyond what they've already invested in with Native. So a lot of the time, that's what ends up on my desk. And so sometimes it'll be a brand looking for something specific to their industry or supply shed. We call that not offsetting, but insetting or insetting adjacent, where they're looking for a material or a product that they require or need for their business and trying to decarbonize that industry or sector. Or we'll have companies who come to us and maybe they want something in a geographic location because that's where they can do, that's where they do business. Yes. So a great example of this, one that I've been pointing to that shows highly meaningful need in the space, is there's a great group out there that we work with right now called Reverb. And Reverb works with bands. And they help bands essentially offset or buy the renewable energy for their complete tour. So they're, in some of these bands' cases, not all of them, but they're offsetting essentially you and I's travel and day going to that show. That cost isn't borne in your ticket or something like that. That is just that band saying, wait a second, we realize that we love doing what we do and we love our fans, but there's a real carbon footprint to us having concerts. Now, should we tell them, no, never mind, we don't want to go to your concert? Or do they want to maybe feel like they can do something about that carbon footprint, that carbon impact that their concert or show is having? So that's another great example where we're able to find people who are looking for either things inside their business or inside their supply shed, or maybe solving tricky problems like trying to offset 20,000 people every night going to their concert. Yeah, big shout out to some of the bands that are doing that. Reverb was actually just announced as one of Time Magazine's 100 most influential leaders in the climate space last week. Wow. So love to see them continuing to do great work.
That's really great. And I know a lot of bands are getting a lot of flack, especially some of these bigger celebrities with their personal jet travels. I think there's one artist that comes to mind that is notoriously known for having huge carbon emissions associated to her private jet. So when companies such as Reverb are offsetting their concert emission, how do we know that those offsets are actually taking place? And how do we account for additionality? Maybe take a second to explain what additionality is to our listeners.
Yeah. So additionality is the idea of, would the intervention or the action had happened without climate finance through the sale of the carbon offset been available? Additionality can take on several different ways it can look. It can look like financial additionality, which I just stated, or maybe there's other additionality, like was a forest already protected? And is the money actually going to continue enabling its protection, conservation, or what have you? So that's additionality in a quick snapshot. How can we verify and validate that the projects that you're supporting are actually meeting what they said they're going to is a really tricky question. I'm sure everyone has seen the Guardian articles and things that have come up in the last year questioning different project developers and groups' practices around this measurement, reporting, verification of their projects along the way. So each project issues a project development form, a PDD is what it's called, or something similar to that. And one way is you could sit and read through all the technical work and read through the specificities and try and prove out the logic yourself. Or there's some great groups like B0 and Silvera and some others who have actually started to rate the various projects and whether or not they're standing up to the mustard that their claims. It's just going to be a continuing, evolving, and challenging process for brands to do this. And so that's why I encourage people to look to other groups who are either doing the buying or have the capacity to do that kind of vetting and reviewing of projects in order to make sure they're not putting themselves at risk. There's political risk. There's climate claims risk. And an ever-growing, as we saw in some projects, accusations over the last 2 weeks, human rights risks that you could be putting your brand in the same bucket as.
I'm a pessimist. If you listen to even one of these episodes, you'll probably catch that off of me. Do you think that these offsets might discourage companies from trying to implement real sustainable changes to their organization? Or does it add up eventually where they're like, oh, we need to make these changes because it's costing us too much already?
Ray, great question. You know, this is studied time and time again. What we find is it's the exact inverse. The companies who are claiming to buy emission reductions off of the carbon market are the utmost leaders in this space. They're doing everything above and beyond to reduce their carbon footprint. And the offsets are actually a way that move them in ambition, not hinder their action and ambition. To be honest, what would you rather do? Would you rather improve the efficiency of your business or have to go out and buy something off the open market that then could, you know, wait, you're telling me you could pose some risk to my brand or my identity? Like corporations aren't buying these things willy-nilly and then hoping that they can get away with not doing any action into the future. It's a little bit of a false story that people keep trying to portray that the market is going to create laggards in this space. But the other bit that we have to just keep in mind and be focused on is we're talking about needing something like a 6 to 8 gigaton carbon removal per year in order to meet some of our later in the century emission reduction goals. So we need to be investing in projects and things that like literally remove carbon from the air today in order to meet those long-term goals. And there's not another finance mechanism available for a lot of those innovative solutions to grab scale. So the money being spent in benefit can far outweigh any kind of challenge that it's going to create for us in the long term, hopefully.
Are we moving towards a mandatory situation? Do we need mandatory carbon markets to be part of our industry?
Well, it's a fascinating point that we're at right now. And so what essentially happened was in order for governments to make the most of the carbon market language within the Paris Agreement, they themselves had to go about and institute and design a process where they can track and release or sell or buy these emissions. And it ends up being they have to create their own marketplace. So when I was working on policy and global government climate exchange a few years ago, we were really focused on helping governments design markets. And we thought there would be no chance that a lot of the governments now today that are announcing they're moving forward with carbon markets, we never thought that was going to be a possibility. Across Africa, across Latin America, Asian countries, it's no longer just US states and the European Union coming to the party. And so we're seeing a big push in this regulated carbon market space right now. And that's going to increase validity. That's going to increase the accountability and the good actors. And I think a little regulatory oversight, especially around things like claims that corporations are making and buying these emission reductions, is going to be really important and really helpful for the market as we move forward.
I want to go back just a little bit, Mike, to what you said and how carbon markets got started. I thought that was really interesting. I didn't know that it was really a climate finance initiative to help some of these developing countries address their climate issues. Obviously, carbon offsets have moved past that. There are now carbon offsets available in North America or by countries going by the first world countries. Last year at COP, we did see a big initiative from Egypt when a lot of these still developing countries pushing for these more developed countries to help finance the different immediacies that they were occurring with climate. So I guess my question is, is the carbon markets still tailored to where they're supposed to be? Are we moving away from what the goal originally was for carbon offsets?
Yeah, no, we're certainly seeing an evolution in what a carbon project looks like. And right now, the big hot date right now in the market is carbon removals, and tech-based as well as nature-based, as I was talking about earlier, carbon removal projects are really important in our long-term goals, but they're also really expensive. These are things that are literally working to take carbon out of our atmosphere, store it in the ground, store it into deep reservoirs or into products and other things that essentially take it out of our atmosphere. And so those are going to gain a lot more attention going forward. And like you said, they don't need to be hosted in one in particular country or another that, say, has rainforests or has some, for the nature-based solution, that certainly helps. But any country essentially can get involved in the game now. And so it's really going to be a time where we moon the carbon metrics of what we're trying to hope from these projects to being really focused on the emissions accounting side. And what I hope we don't lose in that evolution is also the great opportunity of community impact and the finance that this can actually go a long way. And what does that mean is if we have a tech facility in Ohio that is working to suck carbon out of the atmosphere, but it's not creating jobs, it's not creating any kind of benefit for the community in which houses it, then is that really a type of project that we want to be supporting? Because right now, the attention is not just on the carbon accounting for projects, but also really on the social and governance side of them as well. So I hope that is as we move to tech-based removals, we continue to really remember that climate change isn't an issue for our planet. It's an issue for humans. And we need to make sure that the human impact is front and center.
Mike, this has been an absolute pleasure to host you on the podcast. I know we got to let you go. And honestly, I don't want to. I've been enjoying every second of this conversation with you. You might need to be coming back for a COP recap special for your interpretation of what comes out of the COP28 meeting coming up, because I want to hear your read on everything. I really do. It's been fascinating. We wrap every podcast the same way. Mike, what are you listening to? What are you reading? How are you staying involved in the sustainability market? Can you give any quick shout outs for us?
One of the bits of announcements that we're going to see coming out of this COP that I didn't get to talk about is there's going to be hopefully some progression made on our global methane commitments. Mm-hmm. So carbon dioxide, of course, always an issue. But methane, as your listeners will know, has a major greenhouse gas warming potential and can really have a lot of impact. So I'll be following and tracking some of the bits around methane regulation. And so, Ray, what you're seeing is I don't read anything for fun. No, sure. I only read policy and climate stuff. And I watch hockey when I don't have to read things on climate change. I watch hockey.
Don't blame you in the slightest on that front. Well, you've given us so many good tips already on where to follow and find out more information and stay involved. Listeners, please tune in to the next time we have Mike on the podcast to talk about more of this stuff, because this has been a blast. Absolutely. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, guys.
And there's the final bell. Well, Ray, that was a really deep dive into the carbon markets. I haven't really gotten that deep. I learned so much from Mike through the course of this past hour, how we got into this and where is it going and the policies. Loved his take on additionality. That's a really hard concept to grasp. There's so much in it, but he gave a really great explanation. What did you think, Ray?
First off, the fact that I think I can barely spell additionality should tell you all you need to know about what I knew going into this podcast to talk about that. Second, I mentioned it in the podcast. I thought carbon offsets were just that companies were going to pay for a tree somewhere in the Brazilian rainforest, and over the next 100 years, that tree takes out enough carbon to take away one flight from an airplane. I didn't realize the breadth and scope that someone like Mike are working towards, creating new unique carbon offset projects that are more honed and get better and better as we go. And it makes sense. We literally are talking about industries that are built around the concept of sustainability. And mm-hmm. when you have someone working to create an industry around this concept, it makes sense that they would look for better and better projects to make it all work. And so I think that it's fascinating that someone like Mike can come in and find you new avenues for carbon offsets that nobody's ever considered.
I couldn't agree more with you, Ray. And I think that's why it's so important to have people like Mike on the podcast talking around these issues and educating further.
Well, I honestly think that we need to have him back. His insight into so many different facets. And we touched on COP, but we didn't go as deep as I almost think we can. And the good news is COP28 is literally around the corner for us. It's happening right now as you're listening to this podcast, listener, if you're getting it on release day. And getting his interpretation of what occurred might be super fascinating for everybody to hear. Thank you so much for tuning in. We hope you enjoyed today's episode, listeners. Please follow us on Instagram at We Are Made From Stone. We would love to hear from you and what you thought of this episode and episodes going forward. We've been getting a lot of suggestions. In the meantime, we hope you'll tune back in to continue mastering sustainability along with us. Have a good day.